President Trump has brought peace to the Middle East. For thousands of years, they've been looking for peace, and now President Trump has it, or so he seems to argue. Curiously, he's brought this peace with more war and more military strikes and more violent onto a situation that was already pretty violent itself. And we're going to see just how we got there, what prospects there are actually for peace, and what roadblocks may lie in the way. And we have with us today for the first time somebody I've known for a long time, Tretta Parsi, Executive Vice President of Quincy Institute, and an incredibly smart individual who actually, correct me if I'm wrong, Tretta, but you had some role in the original formation of the JCPOA. Is that right?
I wouldn't want to take too much credit, but I was an advisor. Oh, I was advising the administration at the time, and my previous organization had worked, I think, probably more than anyone else in creating the political space in Washington for diplomacy.
Yeah, that's what I thought. And that's one of the things I always thought was so great. And, you know, there's so many people that throw such cold water on that, especially just the political right in the United States just said it was, you know, the most horrible thing. And I wonder if you just kind of right off the top, if you can kind of answer one of the questions that I've had for a long time, that from my external perspective, it's like that deal was never perfect. No deal is. And it did have some flaws, but compared to what the none was before and what the even worse situation was after Trump got out of it in 2018, it was a pretty good deal. How do you view that, especially in hindsight?
No, absolutely. I mean, remember, this was a deal that was struck because otherwise the options for the United States would have been accepting Iran becoming a de facto nuclear power or go to war. And I think the administration made the absolute right decision of not going to war and also trying to make sure that there was something that blocked Iranians in a very effective way from being able to go in the direction of weaponization if they chose to do that. Now, we know that they didn't choose to do that. The deal was working. Even the Trump administration's own State Department certified that twice before Trump decided to pull out of the deal. And that created all kinds of different problems in the region. And now we have a situation after the military strikes that, on the one hand, Trump wants to say that he solved the issue, he destroyed the program, because he wants the issue to be off of his desk. He doesn't want to deal with this. On the other hand, intelligence that is coming in, that the key elements of the program, meaning the 60% enriched uranium, is probably still there and it's probably still intact. Whether Iranians can access it or not, we don't know. How much of it was moved before the attack, we don't know. But bottom line is, there's so many things we don't know right now.
Right. That's one of the big issues.
Yeah, whereas before, we actually had answers.
I'm actually going to get to a lot of that stuff there in a second, but I actually want to kind of set the stage. It was something that happened just, I guess, a little while ago, just shortly before we came on the air here. President Trump was asked, in the context of what's going on in the Middle East, and is there peace between Hamas and Israel, and does that lead to a wider peace? And he says that that peace was set up by the destruction of that very facility you mentioned in Iran.
If you look at the Middle East, I would say prior to us hitting Iran so hard, we could have never made that deal, because you would have had a dark cloud over the Middle East when we took out their nuclear capability, which was one of the great military maneuvers of all time.
Hey, well, one of the great military maneuvers of all time. We'll set that part aside here. But what about the bigger issue there? Because he's made this claim on a number of occasions that without his strike, along with Israel, against the Iranian nuclear facilities earlier this summer, this deal would never have happened. What is your view?
I think there's, frankly, zero truth to that. These two things are completely disconnected from each other. I'll be happy to go into as to why I think Trump actually shifted towards wanting to make this deal, which I'm happy about, although I have a lot of skepticism about how whether it will end up really being fulfilled or not. But I think part of the reason why he's saying this as well, rather shrewdly, is because he's trying to tie this deal that the Israelis are not happy with something that the Israelis are very happy with, as a way of cornering the Netanyahu government and those elements in the Israeli government that want to push back against how he is now finally putting pressure on the Israelis, which is something that we saw Biden never do. We saw Trump do it a little bit in the beginning of his term, but then he let go, and now he's gotten into a situation in which he actually is putting some firm pressure on the Israelis. And there's several reasons as to why he's doing it. I'm happy to go into those factors, but the strike on Iran really had nothing to do with it.
Well, and let's get into this, because the Iranians are saying, which you alluded to a second ago, that didn't happen, first of all. And even prior to that, the Iranian president Pezeshkian said that the strike itself was a grave betrayal of diplomacy. And he said he attributed Iran's reduced adherence to the JCPOA in the first place to the U.S. withdrawal under President Trump, accusing the European three of aligning with Washington, while Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei rejected negotiations, saying this is not a negotiation, it's a diktat and an imposition. Is he right there? Because nobody likes to, or at least not many people like to give any good points over to the Iranian side, but does he have one?
Well, on the idea that bombing someone in the middle of the negotiation being a betrayal of diplomacy, I think is something that is rather easy to agree with. Absolutely. This is not something that in any way, shape, or form enhances negotiations. In fact, there haven't been any real negotiations since those strikes took place. At some point, the administration is going to need talks. In fact, Trump is already signaling that he wants it. And that has been made far more difficult as a result of the strikes. I mean, one of the things that happened with these strikes is that throughout the last two, three decades, the Iranian public, by and large, had been in favor of negotiations because they wanted to get out of their isolation. They don't want to be enemies with the United States. They want to get out of this conflict. But then within the Iranian elite, there had been elements that supported it and elements that opposed it. But it was taking place against the backdrop of a public that was, by and large, supportive of moving in that direction. The strike has changed that to a certain extent, not in the sense that the public doesn't want an end to the conflict, that they don't want getting out of their isolation, but rather that there is now skepticism, cynicism about diplomacy as a result of what Trump did, in which diplomacy is seen as a very naive move that actually endangers the country because it invites the opportunity for the United States to strike. I don't agree with that argument, and I don't think it is correct, but this is a very unusual situation in which the public, at least in the immediate aftermath, I don't know if it may have changed as of late, but in the immediate aftermath of the strikes, actually started to view diplomacy as the naive, inexperienced route to go, and that much deeper cynicism was actually warranted and a rejection of talks. That is not a position the United States wants Iran to be in. In fact, if we want to resolve this issue fully, and if Trump actually wants to make peace, there's going to be a need for talks. And those talks have been made so much more difficult now, politically and strategically, as a result of these strikes.
I'd like to back up a little bit and talk about the betrayal of diplomacy, because in my view, and I actually argued this quite a few times, that betrayal really started a lot earlier. And I'd like your view on, among the Iranian people, not even necessarily the administration itself or the regime itself, depending on where you want to talk about. And that's, let's back all the way up to when the Israeli side destroyed that embassy compound in Syria quite a number of months before that, where they assassinated some people that were decided were bad for peace, and they didn't want to have them living anymore. So they used their missiles and actually destroyed an embassy compound, and they assassinated the chief negotiator for the Hamas side during the president's inauguration in Tehran, et cetera. So a lot of these really bold things happened prior to that. And then you had the two rounds in 2024 of missile strikes back and forth between Israel and Iran. It almost seems to me like it was pretty amazing they were still willing to have the conversation prior to that strike there. How did all of that lead up to Iran still being willing to talk?
Well, I think we have to keep in mind a lot of those actions were taking place, of, as you pointed out, by the Israelis under the Biden administration. When Trump first came in, he actually was saying all the right things. His focus was entirely on making sure that Iran would not get a nuclear weapon. He kept on saying, my only red line is no nuclear weapons. He did not talk about regime change. In fact, he rejected that. He set aside all other issues, including regional matters, missiles, etc. He said, my only red line is nuclear weapons. And then he kept on saying how much he wanted Iran to be a successful state, etc. That is exactly why, you know, the stage was set for talks, and the Iranians showed unprecedented flexibility, actually. So, for instance, you had the Iranian foreign minister going out in the Washington Post with an op-ed saying that there's a $1 trillion business opportunity in Iran because the Iranians, for the first time, would be open to having U.S. businesses come into the Iranian economy. This is not something that happened with the JCPOA. The Iran deal that Obama negotiated did not lift sanctions on American companies going into Iran, and the Iranians would probably not have let them back then. But now they shifted on this very core thing in which, you know, for a long time, they just wanted to keep the Americans out. They were open to let American companies come in. So, and all of this was going quite well until Trump shifted and adopted the Israeli red line, which is not no nuclear weapons, but no enrichment at all, no nuclear program at all. It doesn't matter if it's peaceful or not. Once you adopt that position, then talks ended up becoming very difficult and inevitably would fall apart as they did, because we've gone down that path many times over the course of 20 years. The only time we managed to get a deal was when we accepted there will be enrichment, but we have to demand of the Iranians, and the Iranians have to be very flexible in accepting demands of significant restrictions on their program that would ensure that they don't have the ability to build a nuclear weapon.
Now, you're obviously very well connected in Washington, D.C., and definitely in this environment here. I wonder if you could characterize a little bit the tension, I would say, behind the scenes, maybe within Washington and Jerusalem, about whether some people want to have, you know, acceptable relations with Iran so that they don't have a nuclear weapon, and the other half that under no circumstances do they want the Iranian regime to exist at all, and so they will sabotage any possibility because they don't want this Iranian regime to have a normalized relations with anyone.
So the latter view that you mentioned is the common view amongst the traditional conventional Republicans, as well as many, many Democrats. The view of, you know what, we should actually be able to resolve this issue and then we can move on. The Middle East is not that important any longer. So why are we sticking to these enmities that suck so much of our resources and dragged us back into a region we no longer need to be in? That is more of the view of the America First foreign policy constituency, as well as some folks on the left. They may not formulate it the same way, but they want to resolve this issue. And this is part of the reason why I think the Iranians were quite optimistic about a deal with Trump, because they saw that in his appointments, at least originally, he was not bringing back John Bolton. He was not bringing back Nikki Haley. He was not bringing back Mike Pompeo. And there was an explicit effort to not let a lot of neocons in. But then again, you know, there are folks like Marco Rubio and others who have proven themselves to be much more effective in terms of working with Trump, even though I think by and large they still hold the same views that they did before, which are very close to those of Mike Pompeo and John Bolton. And I think we've seen a lot of impact of that on issues that don't elevate to the level of Trump's attention themselves, because that's where they have maximum leeway of pursuing what they want. And that's where we see them doing things that I think, frankly, are contradictory to the America First agenda. Yeah. But they're not important enough, and they're not reaching Trump's attention span.
Well, things that are reaching President Trump's attention span are other things that are happening in relation to this. One of the things Trump has said over and over since this strike happened is that the strikes obliterated everything in the Iranian regime. So basically he's saying, I attained my goals, which was that they can have no nuclear weapons. And we had the State Department, I think Parnell came on shortly thereafter and said, yep, it's been knocked back probably at least 2 years, et cetera. So didn't knock it off the table for the Trump term, but at least kicked it way down the road, or so he claims. But now then we have, first of all, the Ayatollah himself said, you know, look, just keep dreaming. If you think that you got us knocked out of here, there's no way and if you say this is a deal maker, but the deal is accompanied by coercion, its outcome is predetermined. It is not a deal, but an imposition and bullying. And then the IAEA comes out, and Gary's shown that headline a couple of times, that they say it could be up to 400 kilograms survived that strike, whether some of it was moved out before, whether it's still buried under a lot of rubble in Fordo and Natanz and some of these other places, perhaps. But they seem to think that, yeah, there's probably still a lot there. And we actually had Professor Ted Postol on the show right after this that suggested, or not predicted, I guess, but assessed that that's exactly what would happen, that there was evidence that a lot of it was moved out before, that they knew, these Iranians knew that an attack was coming. So they certainly would have prepared for that and had it somewhere it would be protected. And so then the big question comes in, if that's the case, and correct me if I'm wrong, the IAEA inspector is no longer on the ground. So we're kind of blind to what's actually going on. Is that a fair statement?
I think that's absolutely fair. And this is part of the reason why this is ultimately quite negative for the United States. I mean, look, Trump did this. And in his mind and in the mind of the administration, they did this in order to stop the conflict. I'm just conveying what I think their thinking is. Because there was pressure from the Israelis for the United States to go all in and completely join in with the Israelis in bombing whatever they could in Iran, frankly. And then, of course, it was counter pressure from within the administration from folks who said, look, we shouldn't be doing this at all. We have the opportunity to strike a deal. We should go down that path instead. But by doing the strike only against the nuclear facility and then quickly press the parties for a ceasefire, in Trump's mind, he ended the conflict. He had to go out and say that he obliterated the program, that there's nothing left of it, so that he can have the issue off of his desk. At the time, the Iranians came out and said that the strikes had inflicted considerable damage to the program. They didn't use the word obliterate. And that was actually something that was helpful to the administration at the time, in the sense that it kind of gave a degree of validation to what Trump was saying. But I think everyone knew that Trump had an interest in saying this because he wanted the issue off his desk and be able to declare victory. The Iranians said this because if they said the opposite, then perhaps Trump would felt the urge of doing some bombings.
Yeah.
So everyone is just creating a non-reality that everyone is abiding by, knowing very well that it won't last very long. And here we are a couple of months later, and we get the IAEA coming out and saying that most likely 400 kilos is still intact. I mean, the U.S. gave the Iranians a heads up because Trump did not want to kill anyone. He wanted to make sure that this was a strike that would end the conflict, at least in some ways, and would have very little escalatory potential. And the Iranians would give some sort of response, which they did, which also was very heavily telegraphed, and no one was killed, and that was the end of it, at least for now. That's what he wanted to achieve. That's what he got. But reality, of course, is that this is not fixed, because when people say, oh, this set back the Iranian program 2 to 3 years, we have to understand it may have set back that program 2 to 3 years. That program was a large-scale civilian program for which you need a large number of centrifuges. If you shift towards having a weapons program, that's a much smaller program. You don't need a very large number of centrifuges. In fact, the Iranians had more than 10, 15, 20,000 centrifuges operating. But for a nuclear weapon, the Brits, for instance, built the first nuclear weapon with 20 centrifuges in a basement. So civilian programs tend to be much larger because of the way that the centrifuges are configured, et cetera. A weapons program can be very well hidden in a much smaller space using far less amount of centrifuges. And if this is the direction the Iranians decide to go in response to getting bombed, then no, we have not set back the program 2 to 3 years because we're comparing apples and oranges. We set back a perfectly fine civilian program that did not constitute a threat. And we may now have the Iranians go underground building a different program that actually is for weapons use. And we will have very little intelligence and eyes and ears to be able to know where they're doing it and how they're doing it and if it can be stopped. So I think it's in a more difficult situation. And just one last point.
Yeah, sure.
And obviously, if the Iranians are going in that direction, they're not going to say it until they have it. So they will say exactly what they're saying right now, which is that they've still decided not to build a nuclear weapon, et cetera, et cetera. But that is exactly what they would say if they were building a nuclear weapon. And they won't come out pulling out of the NPT or anything else until they're ready. So because of the fact that we don't have eyes and ears any longer, we don't have any inspections, all of these things being destroyed, we don't have the ability to the same extent that we did before to verify whether what they're saying is actually what they're doing or if what they're saying is covering up something else that they're doing.
Well, and that kind of leads into the next question I was going to ask is, from an Iranian perspective, internally, from what you understand of the regime and the power dynamics that exist in there, what would be the internal pros and cons of having a secret race to a bomb as opposed to, all right, let's just keep going down this path and see if we can avoid another attack and try and live and fight another day? Because there's risk to either direction.
Absolutely. And I think we first have to recognize that the Iranian calculation prior to all of this was that it actually was better not to have a nuclear weapon. Something that many of them are now questioning, some senior people questioning and saying that perhaps that was the wrong decision. But part of the reason why that decision had been made was because of the fact that the Iranians recognize that if they build a nuclear weapon, they will potentially spur a nuclear weapons race in the region. And if all countries or key countries in the region actually build nuclear weapons and the region is nuclearized, Iran would lose a lot of its strategic advantage. Because if you take a look at the map, Iran is a massive country, much larger population than most of its Arab neighbors, or actually all of its Arab neighbors in the immediate terms, except Egypt. And that also has a lot of other conventional military strengths that puts it in a very conventionally favorable position. If, however, Iran were to weaponize, build nuclear weapons, and others would follow suit, then Iran would find itself at parity with many of these countries that otherwise are inferior to it from a conventional standpoint. Tiny Bahrain, that is not even a 30th of Iran's size or population, if they also have a bomb, well, then Iran and Bahrain are more or less at parity. There's an Israeli general who told me that India's biggest mistake was that they tested the bomb. Because prior to testing the bomb, India was 10 times the size of Pakistan. Once they tested the bomb and the Pakistanis quickly followed suit and tested their bomb, then they were equals. And India, to a large extent, had lost a lot of its benefits. The Iranians are well aware of this. This is exactly why the Shah didn't build the bomb, but he wanted to have the capacity to build the bomb if the security environment of Iran changed in such a dramatic way that the cost-benefit analysis of building a bomb would have changed. The one thing that would change that cost-benefit analysis is for Iran to get bombed by the United States. Now, we don't know for
And
certain.
do you think, by the way, do you think that's the reason why Israel never publicly acknowledged that they have nuclear weapons to keep that ambiguity out there so that everybody else doesn't race to a bomb?
Well, I think everyone knows that they have it, but that ambiguity to a large extent was necessary and for the in order for the Western countries not to punish Israel for having built a nuclear bomb. Which in previous decades perhaps would have been a political reality, given the fact that the Israelis were doing something. Not that they ever signed the NPT, but nevertheless, it would create a headache. It was to the benefit of the United States and for Israel and everyone else to pretend as if no one knows whether Israel has nuclear weapons or not.
Well, so along those same lines, though, let's go down that path that you had a second ago. Let's say that the internal dynamics, they say, well, you know what, the Iranian regime, it is going to be, it's the least of the negative things to have a nuclear weapon. So let's go ahead and get one. And now then you say then there would be nuclear parity because others would go. But I mean, that would still be fraught with difficulty. Would the West, would Israel be okay if Bahrain or Oman or Saudi Arabia, which seems to be the closest one that could do it, if they were going to a bomb, how would that dynamic play out? And what would that do to the region?
No, I think you're quite right from a US perspective. I mean, this is part of the argument, of course, as to why a nuclear weapon in Iran had to be prevented because of the risk of the cascading effect and a bunch of other countries getting nuclear weapons, particularly in the region that oftentimes have not had as strong of a diplomatic channels as needed. I mean, the United States and Russia or the Soviet Union had nuclear weapons pointed at each other, but also had a lot of dialogue and direct channels. And at one point in the Cold War, a red line was created between the US and Soviet Union to precisely to prevent any misunderstandings. But you have a situation between Iran and Israel in which there is no formal diplomacy. There's no, standing channels of communication that are reliable. So the risk of miscalculation is immense between the two sides. So in my view, it's fully understandable that there would be an effort from the United States to prevent further nuclearization of the region. My point, though, however, is that what Obama did was actually much more effective towards achieving that. And what Trump has done now, I think, unfortunately, increases the risk of the Iranians going in that direction. There is still a chance, however, there can be a deal made between the United States and Iran. And here I think Trump is much better than other presidents. Because Trump is willing to do big deals in ways that previous presidents wouldn't even dare to dream of, because the difficulty of getting the bureaucracy to come with you, path dependency, all of these different things just created a situation in which creative thinking never occurred in DC. And if you brought it in from the outside, it quickly died. But under Trump, you have a very different situation to his credit. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that it will always be used or always be used the right way. But in a situation as the one between the US and Iran, That is exactly the type of attitude you need to have to resolve a conflict this long that is so festered and is so infectious. The only problem is that he just made his own job, which he had a better chance of succeeding at than anyone else, he made it so much more difficult by caving to the Israelis and striking in the first place.
Well, that's what I wanted to go next. It's the elephant in the room is the Israeli aspect, because in large measure, it may not matter what Trump himself wants to do, because there's this wild card out there that has shown that it's been willing to move a little bit to his pressure. But I think that there's some limitations on that, because especially in the months leading up to this, the many of the Israeli folks, especially since 10/7, have just been lusting after finally a 50 once in a 50 year opportunity, as former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Naftali Bennett said, this is a once in a 50 year chance to go after the head of the octopus, et cetera, to go after it. And they really, really want to get Iran, not to just harm them, but to eliminate them from an issue, i.e. regime change. So are they going to allow Trump to have some kind of negotiated settlement? I mean, strong words, but I mean, what do you think?
So that's a very important question, Danny. And this also brings us back to what we talked about earlier on that I wanted to just quickly address, which is, you know, did the strike against Iran pave the way for this diplomacy in Gaza right now, or is it something else? And I just want to go over to something else a little bit quickly, because it's relevant to the answer to your question. I think there's three things that really happened here that prompted Trump to move in this direction of going forward with this Gaza plan and just, frankly, surprising a lot of nations by putting this forward. The first thing is something that few people have noted, which is that the French and the Saudis were pushing for this initiative at the UN for the creation of a Palestinian state. It was overshadowed by all of these recognition of Palestine, but there was this deeper effort which culminated in the New York Declaration adopted at the UN with 144 votes. Prior to the September meeting, they were actually supposed to meet in July in New York at a special session. That had to be postponed because of Israel starting the war with Iran. And prior to Israel starting the war with Iran, Marco Rubio's State Department had done everything they could to sabotage that conference and even threaten countries from attending it. But it went forward. It was successful. It was adopted, and it actually added pressure to the Trump administration that they needed to do something on this issue. Otherwise, others would take the initiative and run with it. So that's a factor in the background. Then, of course, you have the most important factor, which in many ways was a trigger, which is that the Israelis overreached. They bombed Qatar against U.S. wishes, to the surprise of the U.S., at least according to the official narrative. And it just brought the entire region together against the U.S. It questioned U.S.
And you're talking about the strike where they assassinate or tried to assassinate the Hamas negotiators who were there at the U.S. Request and apparently at the Israeli request.
Exactly. And the Israeli even had paid the Qataris for all of this. So they strike, they fail, but it shows that the U.S.'s security umbrella, official or unofficial, is really not that valuable, because it couldn't stop Iranian missiles. And now it also apparently doesn't work when Israel decides to attack. And if you're one of these Arab countries that have put so much, in fact, all of your eggs in the American basket, hoping that it will protect you against Iran, but now suddenly out of the blue, it turns out that another country, a close ally of the United States, is actually attacking you and the security umbrella is of no worth whatsoever, then why on earth shouldn't these states start having their conversations with the Chinese? When the Saudis announced suddenly a couple of days after this that they are now in a deal with the Pakistanis and the Pakistanis are providing a security umbrella or a nuclear umbrella for Saudi Arabia, I think the message was, you know, which country Pakistan is working very closely with militarily? China. So Pakistan is a stepping stone towards China. I think the Saudis were signaling that they're getting serious about starting to have a much more serious conversation with the Chinese about this, which is, of course, something that from the U.S. side is not something that the administration or any previous administration have required. So this ended up creating a trigger in which something had to change. But then there was a deeper issue, and I think you probably know more about this than I do, Danny. But what I observed and people I talked to show that Israel standing in the America First MAGA crowd over the course of the last couple of months have just been plummeting.
Yes.
And for several different reasons, including what happened with Charlie Kirkland, which there's no evidence, at least that I've seen, that the Israelis actually had anything to do with it. But there seems to be a very commonly held view that they may have had something to do with it, to the point in which, you know, Netanyahu himself had to come out and do a video response saying that Israel had nothing to do with it. And I think that ended up creating a scenario in which truly Israel became a political baggage for Trump.
And, you know, that even aside from whether they did or not, it was certainly confirmed that Charlie Kirk himself had some real clashes with a lot of Israeli people, and he was souring on them. And that by itself had an impact.
Exactly. And that he 48 hours before actually said that he's going to get off the pro-Israel train, or he had lost a lot of donors, etc.
Yeah.
And he was not going to cancel Tucker and others at the request of some of these donors. So there was a break there with some of the key people in that movement. I mean, Tucker already had done so, Steve Bannon, and Charlie, of course, who's falling amongst young American conservatives, was very, very strong. And this ended up becoming a baggage and a headache for Trump. Because he's going into midterm elections, very problematic and challenging in many different ways. And he has this albatross around his neck, which is a Netanyahu government that just keeps on creating problems for him. And as he said to one of the donors from the pro-Israel crowd, my people hate you. What he told Netanyahu, according to what he himself said to Sean Hannity, is you can't keep on fighting the entire world all the time. Essentially, what he's saying is, I can't keep on protecting you and defending you and spending so much political capital abroad and at home just constantly doing your bidding.
Yeah, now, if it's hurting him, exactly.
If it's hurting him, exactly. I'm not saying that this has anything to do with his any passion or empathy for the Palestinians or for the Israelis. This is hurting Trump. Now, we had a similar situation under Biden. This was hurting Biden.
Right.
But Biden didn't care.
Yeah, he might want to have, probably politically should have rethought that, but it sure did come and bite him in the butt.
Exactly. I mean, one of Biden's former officials told me just a week or two ago that, you know, Biden wanted to leave the White House as having been the most pro-Israel president in U.S. history. Why is that a goal? and you know, what's the point of that? Particularly when you yourself, as Biden, has framed the election as the future of American democracy. So apparently you being the most pro-Israel president is more important, according to your own metric, than American democracy. So I think we have to be appreciative of the fact that when Trump's base is starting to become skeptical of Israel and what Israel is doing and the genocide in Gaza, etc., that actually Trump was responsive to it. I'm not saying he's done everything he needs to do or that there's not plenty of things that he's done that I wish he hadn't done. But at least he shows himself to be responsive to it in a manner that I never saw Biden be, despite of all of the polls and everything else that was happening that show that this would be a disaster for his election. And for
I want to shift into the second part of what I want to talk to you about here, because all this stuff with Iran basically is a setup for what's happening on the very tenuous peace process going on between Israel and Hamas. And to your point there that you just made up, I want to bring in here's a video of Steve Witkoff when he was trying to give Netanyahu some love at a recent speech in Tel Aviv.
To President Donald J. Trump.
I had to stop because they were cheering.
Thank you, Trump! Thank you, Trump!
But then you tried to thank Netanyahu.
Yeah.
And?
To Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Oh.
Every time you said his name, they booed.
Look, that's how they feel. I don't feel that way. And I thought he steered his country through some really difficult circumstances.
People think that he prolonged the incarceration of the hostages for his own political future.
I don't think that's the case.
Yeah, I'm going to come back to that. That's a separate question. I want to answer that last one about whether or not Netanyahu prolonged it in order to use the hostage situation to his political advantage. But that issue right there was, you could see on Witkoff's face on the stage, he's like, whoa, he did not expect that.
And look, if we had a functioning media that was actually reporting the conversations that people are having in Israel, we would not have been surprised that so many people there, in that crowd in particular, who are celebrating the release of the hostages, would be booing Netanyahu, because this has been out in the open for a very long time in Israel, that Israel has completely abandoned the hostages, that Netanyahu pursued a prolongation of the war for his own political reasons, and that a very critical element of Israeli culture had been either changed or attempted to be changed, which is that, you know, historically the Israelis have gone out of their way to make sure that every hostage, every soldier is released, including in the case of Gilad, I think his name was, 1,000 Palestinians were released for his release, to a situation now in which the Hannibal directive was ordered, meaning that the Israelis actually would kill their own people in order to prevent them from becoming hostages. I mean, those are two extremes in terms of your attitude towards your own people, towards your own soldiers, to your own citizens. One in which it's better for you to have you dead rather than being a hostage or be kidnapped. And the other one in which they would move earth and ground just to save one single life. And clearly that is not a smooth transition, and a lot of Israelis are completely against it. And this is part of the reason why they blame Netanyahu. Many of the deals that have been struck or have been considered, including the one that was formed thanks to Trump's pressure in January, the ceasefire, was on the table back in July of last year. But then Netanyahu was not pressured by Biden to accept it, so he didn't. And during that course, we had several hostages being killed and who could not come home alive. And of course, we had thousands and thousands of Palestinians completely needlessly butchered by the Netanyahu government. So it's no surprise that a lot of Israelis would be booing Netanyahu. It's a surprise that our media is so bad at covering this that we are surprised by it.
Right. And that kind of leads into the next comment here about this peace process. So there's one thing about being optimistic and kind of laying out a positive stone. And then there's another thing of like going, okay, what planet are you talking about here? President Trump, in this next comment here, and this also came earlier today, says that thank goodness we have peace in the Middle East for the first time.
Right now it's in the hands of others. You know, we have 59 countries that agreed to the deal. We have a peace in the Middle East for the first time ever. We made a deal with Hamas that, you know, they're going to be very good, they're going to behave, they're going to be nice, and if they're not, we're going to go and we're going to eradicate them if we have to. They'll be eradicated, and they know that. And you have Israel would go in 2 minutes if I asked them to go in. I could tell them, go in and take care of it. But right now, we haven't said that. We're going to give it a little chance, and hopefully there will be a little less violence. But right now, you know, they're violent people.
Is there really going to be a peace here? Because it's hard for me to figure out what Trump's actual play is, because I don't know if he just wanted to placate his base because of the issues you mentioned a second ago. But if he did, that's not going to be a permanent one when you're literally demonizing the Palestinian side. You just mentioned a lot of the Palestinian people who have been suffering so egregiously, and kind of wrapping all that together with Hamas, but it doesn't seem to be very clear. And nowhere did he say in any of those comments anything negative about what the Israelis are doing and some of the ways that they've already broken the ceasefire. What do you make of this?
So, look, I think there are plenty of reasons to be highly, highly skeptical. In fact, I was just in a big conference on the Middle East in Europe with several senior officials from many of these different countries. They're all very skeptical. They don't know if this is going to work. They're all, however, extremely supportive for a very simple reason. For the first time, the United States is putting pressure on Israel. And it is doing so in a manner to make it as difficult as possible for the Israelis to undermine this agreement, similar to the way that they undermined and broke the ceasefire back in January, that lasted for 2 months instead of actually going to phase two and phase three. It's not because they have huge faith in the idea or the proposal itself. It's because if the United States finally is willing to put pressure on Israel and change the trajectory of the region, they have no choice but to support it and invest in it as much as they can in the hope that perhaps it will eventually lead to a more detailed plan that can work. But they all know Trump is rather impatient. He doesn't have the patience for extensive negotiations that works out all of the details. He wants to be able to quickly say he struck a deal, he made peace, and then leave the details to be addressed later on and worked out. But by putting his entire political capital and name behind the deal, which was an Arab demand, they wanted to make sure that Trump really owned this as the only guarantee they have to the extent that it is a guarantee, that the Israelis would now be on a better behavior and be worried about undermining the deal, because if they were to do so, they would be directly contradicting and challenging Trump. Whereas with the previous deal, as much as he took credit for it, he didn't do, you know, this whole big event in Sharm el Sheikh and getting 50 heads of states to come there and putting them all on stage together, etc., and this very excessive manner in which he took credit for the deal and put his own name on it. All of that is there as a buffer against Israeli attempts to sabotage the deal in the absence of better guarantees. But for the first time, seeing that Trump was willing to put pressure on the Israelis is the key reason as to why these countries, despite not having high hopes, are willing to put full investment into this approach.
Well, I can certainly understand that from a certain perspective, but then we got to see, you know, how much of an opportunity is there really? And I wonder if you could talk, whether from your sources or just from your knowledge, that there is a certain line of thought that says that the Israeli government, the majority of the Israeli government, considers it anathema to do anything besides continue until a methodical military conquest of the Palestinian areas. And that probably includes both the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, and that they want the ceasefire to fail and they want it to be somebody else's fault. And they want to convince Trump that this isn't going to work. Can they be restrained?
They can, absolutely. But it will require consistent pressure from the Trump administration and from the United States. What we have seen in the past is episodic pressure from the United States, which can bring about a ceasefire, but not sustain it. If we want this to work, and if Trump wants this to truly be the peace deal that he's already touted it as, well, that will require consistent pressure. He can never let his eye off the ball on this one. And of course, it's easier for the Israelis to sabotage it than it is for Trump to sustain it, because as the president of the United States, he has 100 other responsibilities, including a bunch of other foreign conflicts that he has to pay attention to, whereas Netanyahu can be laser focused on this issue. Mm-hmm. And his cabinet minister can be laser focused on this issue. But we've already seen a couple of things in which, you know, the Israelis have killed quite a few Palestinians already. It's just at a lower level than it was before, but certainly not what it should have been if this was a ceasefire that they truly honored. But that we have seen counter pressure from the United States, in which they have privately made it clear to the Israelis that they know what happened and it wasn't what they said that was a Hamas violation, but this was actually something the Israelis themselves had done. It's that stronger and sustained that is the only way of making sure that this actually can last.
And I guess one of the things that might mitigate against that, I'm looking for any kind of shred that I can grasp onto to see if we can get some peace in this area. It's the way this is viewed by the Trump administration. So Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff, I think they're actually in the Middle East right now, and they were interviewed on 60 Minutes yesterday about their views on some of these things. And something Jared Kushner said really got my attention.
You decide to go to Gaza. Mm-hmm. And what did you see?
It looked almost like a nuclear bomb had been set off in that area. And then you see these people moving back. And I asked the IDF, where are they going? Like, I'm looking around, these are all ruins. And they said, well, they're going back to the areas where their destroyed home was, onto their plot, and they're going to pitch a tent. And it's very sad, because you think to yourself, they really have nowhere else to go.
Would you say now, having been there, that it was genocide?
No. No.
Absolutely not. No. No, there was a war being fought.
I mean, you set that whole thing up, and it's really sad is his phrase there. And there's, it looks like I've heard from a lot of people, we've made that comment here, that especially some of the areas of the Gaza City literally look like a nuclear bomb went off, where there's whole sections of the city where there's nothing standing whatsoever. You can look at that and say, well, I mean, there's no genocide that's going on there. And, you know, and then Witkoff adds that, well, but there was a war going on there. Does the fact that there was a war going on justify that level of destruction?
Of course not. And part of the reason, of course, why the genocide accusation has stuck, and you now have a majority of Americans believing that this was a genocide, is because of the systematic effort to starve the population and the statements of Israeli officials themselves, that they are doing this in order to completely eliminate the Palestinians in the area. I mean, though, I think there's about 22 pages of just statements from Israeli officials declaring an intent for genocide that is part of the South African application to the ICJ accusing Israel of genocide. We will see, of course, what the court decides, probably sometime late 26 or perhaps 27. But already now, we just had last month the UN Commission coming out very clearly stating that this is a genocide.
And you see, there's that video right there where there's hardly a building that's even standing at all, much less any kind of intact anywhere. But the question is, where do we go from here? And I'd like to, in the last portion here, I'd like to pull the lens back a little bit. Let's say for the moment that somehow Trump does keep the sustained pressure on the Israeli government and does prevent them from going back in, and enough time passes to where, okay, this war actually is over. And then finally, even the pressure inside of Israel gets sufficient to where they're like, all right, that we're done with this phase, you know, like maybe the second intifada that kind of came to an end, the 2006 Lebanon war that kind of came to an end finally. And then they started trying to move on. But if we get into a situation to where just the pressure goes away and the pressure from all these countries in the world says, okay, finally, whew, breathe a sigh of relief. Now then the people of Gaza aren't being killed on a daily basis, but there's no path to the other points of that Trump peace plan that said there has to be a path to a Palestinian state of some sort, and there is no path, and it's basically just a return to the status quo ante of 6 October 2023, where there was no possibility, except now then they live in that moonscape that you just saw in there. What possibility does that have to not turn into an even bigger problem later?
Absolutely, because bottom line is, as long as the occupation continues, the conflict continues. So the war may end, but the conflict and the underlying factors that brings about this violence will continue to exist. So in some ways, if we get to that stage, that's when the real hard work begins, which is to actually resolve the conflict, not just end the war. And there, again, I think there are pathways. And what the French and the Saudis did in the New York Declaration is putting together a different mechanism that addresses many of the flaws in the Oslo mechanism, the process. But it's still short of all the things that is needed. At least at this stage, there is no, for instance, mechanism on how you pressure the Israelis to abide by international law or whatever agreements is found. Same thing happened in Oslo. There was never any sanctions or anything like that that was imposed on the Israelis despite constant violations of the agreement. So there's still mechanisms and elements of the mechanism that need to be fixed there. But what I think you have is an opportunity to completely declare Oslo dead and then replace it with something else. And here's why I think the United States has a national interest in getting this done. I start off from the point of saying, we should not be in the Middle East, at least not to this extent militarily. The United States is completely overextended. This region is not strategically vital to the United States any longer. The oil doesn't matter as much as it did in the past. So we don't have an interest in having this very strong presence. And I don't know, 3-4 presidents by now have made that promise of getting out of the Middle East. Few of them have done anything effectively to actually fulfill that notion.
One might say none, but...
yeah, but this is the path we absolutely have to go down. The question is, how do you make sure that that happens without the type of a backlash as we saw in Afghanistan, in which, you know, major instability occurred that made any withdrawal look bad and actually made it more difficult to withdraw from other areas. And also ensuring that it is not so unstable that it sucks us back in, because if there's anything we're bad at is to resist being sucked into conflicts. So in that, I think we do need a new security architecture for the region. This is a region that has none of that. It doesn't have an OSCE, doesn't have an ASEAN, does not have any inclusive security body. And I think there's a lot the United States can do to work with the newfound agency in the region itself to move things in that direction. But for that security architecture to ultimately be sustainable, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict does need to reach some sort of a solution with the Palestinians having their own self-determination. So I think it lies in our interest in helping bring that about, not from the standpoint of charity towards the Israelis or charity towards the Palestinians, but because we need to do some of these things in order to facilitate our own military exit out of the region and be able to focus on things that actually really do matter to the United States. If it was so easy as us for just leaving, perhaps that would be a better option. But I think we are quite clear that our political system and our political realities simply doesn't allow for that. But there are ways that we can do things that makes it possible and also makes it sustainable, so we don't have to worry getting constantly sucked back in.
Well, that would certainly be ideal. Probably everyone would benefit for that. But we'll have to leave it on the aspirational table for the moment. But really, really appreciate you coming on and providing these insights you have today. So at least we remain knowledgeable about what's actually going on and where the possibilities are and where the potential problems are. And we really appreciate that. Thanks for coming on today.
Thanks so much for having me, Danny. Appreciate it.
We appreciate you guys too. Always, we remain unintimidated and uncompromised to bring you the truth, no matter what it is, because you deserve to know the truth from any kind of a spin. Just a quick reminder, we are on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podcast Addict. Some of your friends who may like to get their information via podcast instead of the video, by all means, pass this along, or DanielDavisDeepDive.substack.com. for the written word. Thank you very much, folks. And be sure, by the way, to like and subscribe if you haven't done that yet today. We appreciate it. And we will see you on the very next episode of the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.